This podcast takes you into the rarely discussed realm of the personal decisions leaders have taken that have influenced their business decisions and developed them into the leaders they are today. The refreshingly honest experiences of those who have been very successful provide an insight into the challenges they faced, the successes they achieved, and the people who influenced them along their journey. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Hey, great to be in your ears today. Today we have with us Shilpa Strong. Shilpa is the Chief Executive Officer for Tokio Marine Australasia. Her 22 plus years of insurance and reinsurance cross-functional expertise in strategy development, assessments of businesses, new markets and new products. She's also been involved in financial planning, large-scale transformations, intelligent automation and robotics, which all speak to her passion for growth and change. In addition to Tokio Marine, Shilpa has also worked for AIG, Swiss Re, Munich Re and Quanta Capital. She has lived and worked in India, Switzerland, Canada, USA and Australia. She has a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering, which is a strange thing to have in the insurance industry, and a master's in management studies from the University of Mumbai, as well as an MBA in international business from Simon Fraser University in Canada. Welcome to Business Made Personal, Shilpa.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having me here.
Let's start at the beginning. We were talking before we started recording. So where did you actually grow up? Because you've had such a, you know, worldwide experience. Where were you born and how was that for you when you were a young child?
I was born in India and I was raised in multiple Air Force bases all over the country during my formative years. My father, you know, was an engineer. He passed away a couple of years ago and he was an aeronautical engineer and he repaired, you know, aircrafts. And we moved around a lot. There was a lot of change, you know, and I had to quickly adapt to new environments, new schools. It was a lot of fun, actually, to be growing around airplanes. At one point, I wanted to be a pilot. Engineering came a distant second. At some point, I changed my mind. It was a wonderful childhood on an Air Force base.
A lot of people either love it or they hate it when they look back on those sort of formative years. Was it a difficult thing to do to be moving from place to place, particularly when, you know, as you started growing up and particularly through those sort of teen years, was that a difficult phase for you?
Actually, I loved it. I absolutely loved it because we didn't know any different. We had family in the larger cities. We always lived on Air Force bases and we were always thrilled to go visit my grandparents. But it was a life we knew. It was a life which was very self-contained. We were very busy doing different things, playing sports. You know, we had to amuse ourselves on a small Air Force base. It wasn't too difficult because once we get used to it, even when I got to be a teenager and we moved to Mumbai, you know, I just simply adapted. I just formed new friends and off we went. So it kind of makes you pretty adaptable and flexible, you know, that kind of a lifestyle. But looking back now, if I had to do it, you know, I'm moving countries these days. However, it's not that easy. As a young child, it's a lot easier.
It probably speaks to why you are very adaptable, right? Because you've really experienced it from young sort of childhood. How old were you when you finally settled in one spot?
I think I was 15 years old when I moved to Mumbai for higher education. So my father at some point decided we needed to be independent. and he sent us away to school in Mumbai. And in India, your 11th and 12th grade, you can do it in a college. So that's when I got some stability for the next almost 7 to 8 years, just going through higher education, my undergraduate degree, my master's degree. I spent a lot of time in Mumbai before I decided to move to Canada.
Well, we'll get to the move to Canada because I'm intrigued at how your career has blossomed. But I want to go back to the opening where I said you've got a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. So you're a long way from an engineering career. What happened?
Oh my gosh, a lot of things happened in between. Like I said, you know, I really dreamt of being in technical fields, being a pilot, having grown up on Air Force bases. My father was an electrical engineer as well. Electrical engineering has given me a great foundation, great conceptual, analytical, problem-solving foundation that I use even today, every day, right? The training was technical, quantitative. I decided to study electrical engineering because I loved math and physics. I enjoyed it. After my engineering degree, I got a job in manufacturing. And that's when I started to realize that I was more of a people's person. And I took a sales job to move out of my comfort zone. It was selling computers. And I found I was good at it. I had the resilience and persistence that was required. I was fascinated by the business world, and I wanted to know a little bit more. That took me to a master's degree in marketing and eventually an MBA that started my management career. I joined Swiss Re out of school, out of Canada, which is where I was doing my MBA. And the rest, as they say, is history, right? You know, I just got into the reinsurance first and then insurance industry. And I've been, you know, in the industry ever since. In hindsight, I think it was the right decision for me to do electrical engineering at that point. It has really worked for me because my career has been in finance and insurance, and I moved to transforming company over the last 10 years, and it has helped me. It has helped me in the areas of technology and automation. You know, I gravitate more towards those areas and easily because of my training. So all in all, you know, ultimately it all comes together.
Let's talk a little bit about you moving to Canada, because you wouldn't have been a mature person at that stage, I wouldn't have thought. Oh, well, you might have been mature mentally, but certainly you weren't in age. What was the catalyst for you going, you know what, that's a great idea? Did you have family there, or was it you were just on your own?
No, I was on my own. I still remember as I was getting excited to, you know, get on a plane and go to Canada, my dad asked me, all right, it's great. Is anybody going to come pick you up? Do you know where to go? And I looked at him, said, oh, no. So I called up the international office and, you know, made arrangements. It was something I always wanted to do. One of the greatest inspirations for me was my grandfather. And he was an educationist. And in his late teens, early 20s, he moved to England, studied, and he came back. And he started schools and universities in India. And he was a very charismatic person, and you know, I was really motivated by what he did, and I always wanted to follow in his footsteps. I didn't exactly follow in his footsteps. I never really returned to India, even though that was my intention. When I moved to Canada, I moved there to do an MBA. I was on my own. I absolutely loved it. It taught me so many different things. It taught me to be financially independent. Even though I was independent in India, living apart from my family, I was still financially dependent, you know, on my family, my parents. But Canada was quite the experience. So, you know, you just make it work. You just figure things out for yourself on your own. So,
well, you got no choice, right? I mean, once you're there, what were the sort of challenges you faced during that time, Shilpa?
I think in the beginning, there was always the excitement, right, of moving to a new country, exploring the country culturally, new school, new friends. But the challenge initially was pretty much financial. So I had to figure out really quickly, you know, what I was going to do with the limited opportunities as a foreign student who could only work on campus. But we figured it out, got a scholarship after I got there. And, you know, initially when you move to a new country, you know, the food is different. You have a different accent. You know, the way universities work, they're very different from the way they worked in India. So you had to adapt and adjust. And I absolutely loved it. It took in that experience. And a year and a half went by very quickly before it was time for me to move to Switzerland, because I got a job to work for Swiss Re.
In Switzerland?
Yes. So I moved from Canada to Zurich, Switzerland, to work for Swiss Re.
I guess you'd probably got a bit of a feel for what that whole moving thing was like. And was that the time you thought, you know what, it's not as big a deal as maybe some people make it out?
Yes, absolutely. Because at that point, you know, I always had a dream of living and working in different countries. And that was just the culmination. And it was very easy for me to move. I hadn't collected too many things. There were just two suitcases. The rest I left behind and moved to Zurich. You know, joining a multinational and a global company such as Swiss Re was very easy, right? They made it easy for me. I was a part of a management training program and we were from, I think, 10 different nationalities. They were experimenting with something new then, and the move wasn't too difficult. We didn't have to spend too much for ourselves or figure things out. They helped us settle in.
And, you know, a lot of people listening to this podcast will be looking at their careers and wondering whether they should do an overseas stint if they get the opportunity. People like me are probably too scared to do it. I moved from India to Australia. That was enough for me. But you've worked for AIG, Swiss Re, Munich Re, Quanta Capital. You're currently at Tokio Marine. You've been in the US, China, Hong Kong, Italy, Germany, France, UK, even the Nordics. You've looked after groups in Australia and Latin Americans. I just want to know, do you think those times that you actually moved to places like Switzerland and you moved to Canada, what sort of value did they give you for then your career moving forward that you wouldn't have got if you'd stayed in the one country?
I think that's a very good question. I think if you really think about it, it's fundamentally confidence. It really helped build my confidence because I could tell myself, hey, you know, I can be anywhere, you know, and I can make it work. I can be in any situation and I can make it work, you know. So I think being in different environments and figuring things out for yourself just gives you confidence. I think, at least from my perspective, I think that really helped. By the time I got to New York, again, which was my dream, you know, to get to New York, work in New York, growing up as a child in India, you see all these Hollywood movies and all the business, you know, based movies you want to be, you know, when you get there, it's a little overwhelming, but soon, you know, your training and your experiences kicks in and it just makes it a little easier to adjust, you know, to adjust to a very fast-paced environment because you know you can handle it.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it, actually. It's the confidence level, isn't it? Because that's the thing that usually stops people from doing a lot of things.
They are our own worst enemies sometimes, you know?
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about your insurance career. So you kicked off in reinsurance, as you said. Then you moved to primary insurance with major global insurers. Do you think that big businesses these days are more focused on the bottom line and shareholder value as opposed to staff welfare?
Right. The way I look at it, from my experience, I look at it holistically. I don't think it's one or the other. To the contrary, I think these businesses must focus on people because they're key assets, especially in our industry, right? Insurance, reinsurance is the people, right? We're not manufacturing widgets. Even if you're manufacturing widgets, you still need people, but you know, you can still automate. But in our industry, I think it's really important. People are the key assets. And each company, I think, has its own journey. Its own journey, you know, and that's best realized by people working together effectively. But I think the organizations have to strike a balance across the various strategic pillars, their financials, you know, their customers, clients, and employees, regulatory compliance. So that makes welfare of our people part, very integral part of our growth. It's an integral part of our growth, and I'll explain in a little bit, and of the bottom line. And that leads to your shareholder value, right? On a day-to-day basis, we have so many people-related challenges that we solve for. We turn around businesses, we turn around, you know, teams, individual performers, underperformers, and we have to have the right policies for the welfare of the staff. For example, you know, you need to have 360-degree feedback. You need to have a progressive culture to attract, retain, inspire, and engage them. From my perspective, I think over-communicating, sharing immediate feedback is really important because a happy staff will drive the top line and the bottom line results. A happy staff will service the clients better. And that way, you're aligned to the bottom line and to the shareholder value. So I feel very strongly, unless you have both, you know, you really can't accomplish. But many a times, I think probably businesses looking at it and from a short-term perspective probably tend to miss that. But that's always been, you know, my philosophy. And that's how I look at when I manage teams, when I manage businesses and I manage companies, I look at it from a holistic perspective.
Oh, no, definitely. And in fact, it sort of springboards me onto another question, which is really about, you know, having happy staff and having that sort of collaborative approach. With people working from home these days, there has been research out there that said, you know, when the pandemic started, people were putting a lot of discretionary effort. With people working from home, you know, the sort of the gloss went off that side of things, and maybe the discretionary effort these days isn't as high as it would have been if you were in the office and you had your people around you and you're able to be self-motivated but also externally motivated. Where do you sit on the working from home thing? Do you think that's been a blessing or do you think it's been a curse from a business perspective?
Our environment and life is always changing, right? So we've got to adapt. I believe in a hybrid work culture, right? There are pros and cons. And, you know, from working from home and from working from the office, you know, when you want to build a culture, you want people, you know, around the same table, interacting, collaborating. But it doesn't have to be 5 days. You know, it can be flexible. It can be 3 days. It can be 4 days. At Tokio Marine, we've adopted a three-day, you know, work week. We've been pretty flexible. So we don't even have hard and fast rules about when to come in. We do have a stand-up weekly, but we allow people to join on Teams. I do feel, however, a company going through transformation, which we did, you know, in trying to fix the basics and transforming and building the foundations, it's really important to have that face time. But with 3 days a week, I felt we got the face time that we needed. So to me, I think if you can allow people that flexibility, you know, of a day or two, I think it works wonders because, you know, people can have their work-life balance and be productive. They can have the time at home to be extremely productive without disruptions from their colleagues, because there are times when you need to sit down and think about stuff. And if you have to write, you know, a paper or a memo, you do need that time and you have to do some deep analysis. You don't need to be in the office to be able to do that. I'm not so sure about 100% remote, but I definitely think a hybrid model definitely works.
I want to pick up another comment you mentioned that, you know, when you talked about working in New York and originally it was overwhelming. And so during your time in New York, you were the chief innovation officer at Tokio Marine. And one of your objectives was to establish, in inverted commas, your words, a groundbreaking innovation culture. How difficult was that to do in a large organization?
Now, that's a very good question, because I tried to do that not just at Tokio Marine, but also in my prior life at AIG, which was what I found is in my experience. And I had to learn that and adapt and implement that in my day-to-day behaviors. Change is very difficult for most people, you know, and if you're that change agent as an innovator trying to kind of instill, you know, behaviors, and to be successful at doing that, you have to be able to break it down. You have to be able to break that change down and make sure that what matters most to people that are impacted by change, you know, that you work around that and make sure that you get that comfort level, you know, to people. You are a profitable business steeped in the traditional ways of doing business and you're making money, right? Despite those, some of those practices being outdated, you're more reluctant and more unlikely to change, right? My philosophy really is mindsets and behaviors and bringing people along for the journey, whether it's any kind of change, whether it's innovation or any changes that you want to make to a culture. Don't want to push innovation in a confrontational manner, but work with the leaders to demonstrate what's out there. Because if you tell people versus demonstrating and bringing them along for the journey makes a huge difference. And even though there was some resistance in the beginning in many of these roles that I've played, it has been a success. It has been a success because you want to tell them how to modernize their business without really impacting people. What are people afraid of? What's going to happen to my job? So you bring them along and tell them, look, this is only to get you to make your life easier, to get you to do your job better. And innovation does that, right? Innovation does that. And how do you repurpose people to do more value-added stuff? Two levers I use is word of mouth. The word of mouth can happen only when you have a success, a quick win, a lighthouse to demonstrate. So what I've done is to infuse that innovative culture. I've scanned the environment and looked and said, who's the most progressive? Which is the most progressive business? Or who's the most progressive person? And how can I work with that person and understand their challenges? And how can I bring innovation to them? Once you do that, we have a lighthouse and a success, guess what? Word of mouth takes over too. Of course, you have to complement that, you know, with making sure that you're also doing exciting things, like, you know, demonstrating and bringing people and showing them successes and telling them, hey, this is how it works, having some kind of a steering, having events, some Shark Tank events. And there are so many different things that you could do to create a momentum and excitement around some of these initial successes. So yes, in the beginning, it's a little difficult, but I've always felt you can quickly demonstrate what good looks like, right? And what excellent looks like as well. It has worked very well for me in the prior roles that I've been in.
And it is a tricky maneuver, particularly, I think, with larger organizations, to get everybody on the bus, right? Because as you said earlier, many people don't like change. And we've seen that happen, particularly in Australia, with a number of insurers where they look to restructure. And some of it goes well, a lot of it doesn't.
That's right. Absolutely right. And look, I think you don't want to, this is not a big bang approach. It's incremental too. So you have to have the patience. The organizations will also have to demonstrate patience. Because once the momentum picks up, then it goes pretty fast. Hmm. It takes a while. And you've got to work with that time frame.
I want to switch topics for a moment, please, Shilpa Strong. I want to talk about diversity and inclusion. As a woman working in the Australian insurance space, it is relatively heavily male-dominated. Not so the case in Asia, as I understand it. What are the sort of challenges you've had to face here that you may not have faced in other parts of the world, do you think?
That's a very good question. I think challenges for myself, you know, and challenges for women in general, I feel, are pretty common across the world, whether there are more women in the business or less women in the business at different levels, right? And some of them I may not have experienced them myself. For example, some of the challenges women face is navigating careers and motherhood. That's common across all countries, whether it's Australia or Asia. Of course, you know, I feel in Asia, there's more support systems because of the way societies are structured, you know, and the family life and the structure of the family compared to here. But that challenge still remains across the board, because I've seen a lot of friends and family members give up their careers, you know, to be able to balance that. The other challenge I feel is, yes, the insurance industry has predominantly been dominated by males, but there are women you see in various managerial and leadership positions across the globe, and it's changing quite a bit only because of certain policies of some of the large organizations, right? There are sponsorships, there's inclusion policies, you know, there's people are more open to diversity of thought and diversity of how, you know, people from different backgrounds and what they bring to the table, right? But there is still a challenge, right? Because I feel women may not be the first people go to for open roles. And I remember earlier in my career, I was dissuaded, you know, to take on a frontline role in sales because it involved working in the rough and tough world of the dealers, you know, at the dealerships. And instead of them asking me to take a job on the corporate side, which is much easier and cushier, you know, it's more appropriate, right? So, but I went out of my comfort zone and I said, now I want to do that job. I want to see, you know, so you have to, even though people may shy away from giving you those roles, you have to kind of lean in and take on those roles, right? So, and those challenges, I think, are still probably there within the industry. Last but not the least, to be recognized, I think women, even at this time, still have to produce extraordinary results, you know, to be recognized. You know, and they shouldn't shy away from working, even if it requires working twice as hard. You know, that's because it's only through, again, like I said, lighthouses and role models and people in positions that will bring more women into the workforce. And when they see women balance, you know, the family and the work life, I think that'll motivate people and inspire people, you know, women to kind of to not give up, you know, earlier on, or not give up when they hit the roadblock, you know, in their careers.
We're speaking with Shilpa Strong, who's the Chief Executive Officer for Tokio Marine Australia. Shilpa, I want to talk more broadly about insurance, the industry itself, and apart from the ability to travel to different parts of the world and live in different parts of the world, what has the industry given you that you never expected to get out of it?
I think what I didn't know even before I joined the industry, it's given me a platform to explore and exploit various facets of my skills. Because there's enough complexity, there's enough challenge in the industry to be able to explore. And honestly, I've been given those opportunities. Some, I had to go after those opportunities very aggressively, you know. But in many instances, you know, I could see these opportunities there, you know, like they were visible. And some instances, I was approached to do certain jobs. And that's incredible, you know, across the board. So a platform, you know, to work in many different markets, platform to bring to the table and demonstrate and be successful. Because that also is important, because you have to be set up for success as well. And it's a fascinating industry. It's absolutely fascinating. When I first joined the industry, I had no idea, because I joined the reinsurance industry. I remember going to the library in Canada at Simon Fraser University that I attended just to look up what reinsurance was. And I had no idea what I was getting into. So not marketed as well. You know, and you said that at the very onset. How do we attract talent? How do we attract more people to this industry? It can't be every other person you meet is an accident, you know, is accidentally they fell into this, you know, this industry. We have to make it more proactive. We've got to attract the right talent, because there's incredible amount of data in this industry. We want people with the smarts and the quantitative skill sets, you know, to join the industry and to make it cutting edge. We still lag behind. We have this reputation of lagging behind other financial services and banking. If we can bring in the right talent and if we can get the visibility, I think that would really be a huge game changer.
And I always say it doesn't matter what degree you've got, there's a spot for you in insurance, right?
Absolutely right, because it's just the multifaceted nature of the business. You have a role for everybody, right? If you want to be a quantitative, you can be that. If you want to be in front of clients and be in the distribution role, you can be that. Or if you want to do human, I mean, there's just, you know, multitude of opportunities.
So they say, there's a saying that goes something like, successful people are a result of the mistakes they make, but more importantly, what they learn from those mistakes, Shilpa. What do you think you've learned from some of the mistakes you've made along the journey?
A couple of things, though, one at a company level and personal level. I worked for a startup that failed, and that was an incredible experience. When people ask me, what's the best experience you've had over your career? That was it, because I learned so much. I learned that you could have the best idea. We were way ahead of the time. Best idea and the best strategy. But if you can't follow it up with execution, you know, just don't get anywhere. That was the biggest lesson I learned. And I've honed my execution skills. You know, I've always made sure that I was in a strategy role, you know, for a while, and I made sure I took up operational role, you know, to get that experience. The other at a personal level is you can never get enough about socializing. You have to socialize, you know, whether you think people are on the same page as you are, but if there's a new idea, new thought, or any day-to-day thing that you want to bring people along and collaborate, socialization is really, really important. You know, over-communicating that idea over and over. You think, you know, that you've communicated enough, but it's never enough.
I know exactly what you mean. I want to talk a little bit about if you were to go back to that 15-year-old and you're now speaking to the 15-year-old Shilpa, what advice would you give her, Shilpa?
Be patient. You know, I would say, you know, because working hard, resilience, persistence, all that developed, you know, was always there and it developed, but patience, I think I would say, you know, be patient and you'll get to your goals. You know, when I was 15, I was pretty, and starting off in the workforce, I was pretty impatient to get to the next challenge. And, you know, sometimes you have to enjoy that journey.
It's a fine line, isn't it, between pushing to progress your career and sitting back and waiting. And I think people who have that sort of desire are not really good at sitting back and waiting. I want to ask you about, you know, you talk about, you know, from the age of 15, you sort of were doing things with a career in mind. During that time, was there a significant turning point in your life, Shilpa?
Yes, there was. I think my decision to, I had already started working in India, but my decision to take a chance and go abroad was pivotal, right? And that, you know, even though there was a lot of excitement, but it also, there was a lot of unknown. And to take that chance, you have to be able to take that risk. But once you jump in, you know, you figure it out. Somehow you make it work. And that's the leap of faith, you know, that you have to take sometimes. So to me, that was leaving my comfort zone, my family, everybody, and going into the unknown was pivotal. But looking back, I think that excitement was so much that I kind of blocked everything. I said, yes, I'm going and I'm doing it. That was a pivotal moment because it was also a time, you know, as a single professional from a country that's steeped in culture and which where they look at not letting, you know, the certain, how can I put this? It's when you're that age, it's not common from a family's point of view to allow your daughter, your granddaughter, your niece or nephew to go abroad to pursue a career, you know, pursue a degree or a career or whatever it is, right? So that to me was important for me to do. There were a lot of, luckily I had a father who supported the decision I took, so it made it a lot easier.
And I was going to say, having grown up in India myself, you know, I was only there till I was a young boy, but even so, those cultural values are embedded in you very early on, aren't they?
Absolutely. There's certain things you do, there's certain things you don't do.
And it's very clear. I want to talk about your career for a minute. What's been the most challenging time in your career, Shilpa?
I think one of the challenging times was, I mean, I loved my job and I was excited to do the job. But at the same time, it was very challenging because I was in charge of transformation and in charge of multiple different initiatives that required me to travel quite a bit, which was still fine. But I had somebody in some part of the world and I needed to be 24/7, literally, which was exciting, which was great. But the most challenging part of that job was headcount reductions. And to me, even though we were doing it in a manner, it was not just, you know, cutting expenses, we were retooling people to do a job in a different manner, automating and giving them other tools, but it was still back there, right? And that part for me was really hard. So, but that's a part of life and it still affects you.
They're never easy things to do. I remember having to let go of someone that was getting close to 65 and I still remember it to this day, even though it goes back a long way away. Fortunately, he did get another job, but it caused me a lot of sleepless nights. And because it's the human factor, isn't it? If you're a people person, as you mentioned before, it's that part that actually impacts you, right?
And somehow you've got to figure out how to compartmentalize it.
I've got a couple of final questions for you, Shilpa, before we let you go. The first one is, you've been in this industry now for quite a period of time. If there was one thing you could change about it, if there was one thing you could change about the industry, what would it be?
I think, and I'm going to give you an answer, which I think one thing I could change about this industry would be for the industry to use more data to make decisions. And that's been an endeavor of mine too, right? As I've done different roles, to me, that would really change things for the industry itself. There's so much data across the board, but we haven't tapped it. We don't analyze enough and, you know, we don't use it enough on a regular basis. So that's one area that I think we could do more. It's happening now with a lot of insurtechs and with a lot of, you know, with machine learning infusing the various facets of the business, it's happening.
I think there's also an opportunity for us as an insurance community to share that data, so that you don't have to reinvent the wheel at Tokio Marine and I don't have to reinvent the wheel at XYZ Company. We can actually, if you're able to, obviously, if it's not confidential, particularly with listed companies, but certainly there's enough general data that we could share that helps not just the industry, but the actual end client, I would have thought.
Well, absolutely.
I just want to ask you a couple of questions left. If you were to give advice to someone that is looking to enter the insurance space, what advice would you give them?
What I would tell them is this is a fascinating industry. It has a complex nature, right? And the way it adds value and the way the impact it has on socioeconomic facets of, you know, of our society, there is an opportunity, you know, to give back. And somebody starting in this industry has to figure out where they fit in first, you know, across that whole spectrum of the value chain, right, of insurance, and pick your spot. But at the same time, I've seen in from my experience, depending on, you know, the company that you're joining and culture, if you want to, you can either go deep or you could go across multiple companies and become a generalist. And all these opportunities exist. And it's what you make of them. I think they're pretty open-minded. The industry itself and a lot of the companies are pretty open-minded, you know, in giving all of us, you, me, everybody, right, that opportunity to figure it out. Yeah. So you don't have to pigeonhole yourself. You come in and take the time to figure out where you want to be. And that worked for me as well when I first walked in and I said, maybe I want to do this, maybe I want to do that, you know, maybe I want to do both and try it out. So that's the advice I would give is, you know, when you enter the industry, you're still very young and take the time to figure out best to your personality, to your persona, to your skill sets and your dreams and aspirations, right?
Absolutely. And final question, what's next for Shilpa Strong?
So what's next for me from the context of where I am sitting here today, we've done a lot of work in the last 18 months to get the company ready in terms of fixing some of the basics and the foundations. I think finding the opportunities for growth and profitable growth here at Tokio Marine. So, and we are very excited about the next phase of our journey. That's what I'm going to be focused on.
Spoken like a true Tokio Marine spokesperson. Hey, Shilpa, thank you so much for being with us on Business Made Personal. It's been just delightful to talk to you.
Likewise. Thanks so much. It has been wonderful to be here.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera, and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.